This is The Sector, the radio show podcast discussing the world of nonprofits, social justice, activism, and charities. A place where we discuss and debate the world's progressive politics, social issues, and all kinds of related topics on the realm of social justice. My name is Ethan Clow, your host, and we are broadcasting right here on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver, as well as streaming live at CITR.ca, and of course, via podcast, whenever, wherever, as technology permits. Well, good morning to everybody who is listening live, and good morning to everyone who's listening via podcast, whenever, wherever you are. Hopefully it's been a great week. It has been a very interesting week in terms of politics and social justice. Of course, the Canadian political scene is heating up a lot more. We're getting more and more information from our candidates, including some interesting news on debating, interesting news on the platforms of the party. There's been some developments on the green side of things, some hastily deleted information regarding some sort of feminist issues about leadership and that direction that the party represents. Again, a lot of debate kind of rose up around that. Interesting because, you know, the Green Party hasn't always been a mainstay in Canadian politics. I mean, really hasn't been one ever. As the party becomes more well-known and ultimately becomes more like a legitimate fourth party, it'll be interesting to see how they adapt to the wider world of politics and, you know, politicking, I guess we could say. The NDP, of course, were also in the news because of the women's debate that McClare pulled out of, although not the first political leader to do so. Ultimately, that debate looks like it's going to be shelved. You know, the whole question of debates has been raised. Stephen Harper obviously been very resistant to doing debates. Justin Trudeau, of course, I think wants to get in front of the camera as much as possible. So, you know, do debates really make a difference? Do they matter to the political scene? There's actually, you know, pardon the phrase, lots of debate on that particular issue. So maybe we'll talk about that a bit later on the show, or we'll save it for next week. We do have a full slate of topics for today. But speaking of being here at CITR, I actually had the opportunity to come by and visit the new studio. I love it. It's so much nicer than the old one. You know, it's cleaner, it's sleeker. It's sort of like having a brand new iPhone. It's just got that very shiny look. But it was funny because I was wandering around the new Student Union building, which is called The Nest, which I think, as I mentioned before on the show, I think it's a bad name, and looking at the different like coffee shops and the restaurants and the way it's all laid out. And it does kind of give you the impression of it's sort of like gentrification, because you've taken the old kind of brutalist design of the old Student Union building and replaced it with this sort of new sleek version. And again, it is kind of like walking around inside an iPad. It's got these very smooth white walls, very clean, very calming, and it's an interesting thing. And it's also funny to look around UBC and, you know, walk around, look at all the new buildings that are being constructed. And you do see that there's a big, strong push to get rid of the old style of university building, the dorms, the old Buchanan buildings. Everything has been kind of redesigned to have a very more open and very friendly exterior, which is interesting because I always wondered, does that not take away some of the character of campus? One of the things that I mean, I can't say that I enjoyed this, but when I was doing my undergrad here, and I went into the Buchanan buildings, and it was cramped, and all the tables were like wood, and they hadn't been replaced or even really cleaned since like the 70s. There was a very, I don't know, university feeling to it. I kind of felt like I was sitting at a table that maybe some, you know, genius sat at like 20 years ago. Nowadays, everything feels very sanitized. And I mean, that's great because we want university students to have a nice, clean environment to do their work in. But at the same time, it would be nice to see a bit of personality as well. So that's an interesting topic, I guess. Do you think that UBC has lost some of its personality, some of its charm in becoming so sleek and new and exciting? Well, I'd love to hear your thoughts on that. You can email us at sectorpodcast@gmail.com. Let us know. Maybe I'm just being a bit of a, you know, get off my lawn type thing, but we'll see how it is. Anyway, like I said, great show today here on The Sector. We have a bit of a tech news. Previously on the show, a couple of weeks ago, I mentioned Windows 10 and the free update that everybody was getting from Microsoft. Well, it turns out that Microsoft may be getting a bit more out of that bargain than we initially thought. Turns out Windows 10 might be spying on us a little bit. So we'll investigate that news story coming up. And additionally, we're going to be talking a bit about police violence here in Canada. And this is a topic that we kind of hinted at in previous weeks, discussing spying by the RCMP, discussing police brutality in previous episodes. So we'll touch base on that a little bit here from a Canadian perspective. And then later on, we'll dive into some politics, talking about Stephen Harper and democracy, as well as the sort of central question of the economy in today's political debate. So we'll come on to that in a little bit. Before that, we're going to take a quick break here on the show, and we'll return after this with more Sector Podcast. Stay tuned.
Whoever said money can't buy you friends obviously wasn't a member at CITR. When you become a member, you get the Friends of CITR card with incredible discounts on Commercial Drive and other areas at
Bill and Rattle Music Limited, High Life Records, People's Co-op Bookstore, Audio Pile Records, Bad Bird Media, Band Merch Canada, Vancouver Music Gallery, and Pandora's Box Rehearsal Studios.
To find out more, visit us in room 233 of the sub on the UBC campus or go online to citr.ca.
Shut up and listen to me right now. This is Fred Schneider, and you're listening to CITR. Shut up and listen to this radio station.
And we are back here on The Sector with me, Ethan Clow, discussing the world of nonprofits and social justice right here on CITR. Well, before the break, I mentioned Windows 10. And this was something that's kind of interesting in the sort of social justice sphere. It's not like the usual kind of topic that we would, you know, think of when we think of social justice. However, a few, I guess, months ago, back when Windows 10 was first kind of, we were learning a little bit about the system, Microsoft announced that it was going to be free, a free upgrade from people who had Windows 7 or Windows 8. And then they said, in fact, it's going to be free for everybody. It doesn't matter if you have Windows 7 or 8. In fact, you can just freely pirate it if you want. The reason being is that Microsoft had way more to gain by just putting Windows 10 out there and having everybody use it than they did for making somebody, you know, already have a legitimate copy of Windows to use it. Since then, they have changed that policy. They backtracked really fast, and you have to kind of wonder, you know, what behind-the-scenes event took place that made them backtrack that quickly. But anyway, you do need a legitimate copy of Windows 7 or 8 in order to get the Windows 10 update. That's not too surprising. I mean, I remember kind of being a little bit skeptical of that when I first heard it as well. What's interesting, though, is that now that Windows 10 is out, and though it's getting very good reviews, there has been some very interesting implications and discussions regarding privacy on a Windows 10 machine. It turns out that Windows 10 not only has the ability to spy and collect data, and that in of itself is not too surprising. I mean, Google has been doing that for a very long time. Facebook, Twitter, all those things do that. What makes Windows 10 a bit different is that Windows 10 actually says in its license agreement that it will collect your information, it will share it if required by law enforcement. Additionally, it tracks things like your activity so to better advertise to you. You know, all the kind of general things that we've come to expect from a major operating system like Windows or any kind of cloud-based computing technology. Now, fortunately, there are in fact ways to turn this off. What's interesting, of course, is that you have to go through quite a lot of hurdles to get through this process. According to some reports, you have to go through about 13 screens to get through and remove the invasive features. Additionally, you have to turn off certain key Windows 10 technologies, such as Cortana, which is the voice-activated function that was meant to sort of counter Apple's Siri. Another reason that Windows 10 made headlines with regards to privacy and data was that news broke that Windows 10 could, in theory, detect and disable pirated software running on your computer. So if you had downloaded a copy of a game illegally or, a program like Microsoft Office, Windows 10 could actually disable that that program remotely by just detecting the fact that you don't have a valid license for it. And a lot of people, not surprisingly, freaked out. Many of the torrent tracker websites banned Windows 10, which I guess is kind of a roundabout way of dealing with it, since, you know, Windows 10 is supposed to pirate in the first place, but whatever. The whole point being is that people were very, very concerned about the way that Windows 10 assumed to have authority to remove various programs from your computer. Now, there's a bit of debate about whether or not that can actually happen. Based on sort of reading this story, it looks like it may be possibly an exaggeration, possibly not. It's certainly possible that Windows 10 could have a way to detect a pirated Microsoft program like Office or a Microsoft or Xbox-related game. It's also entirely possible that Windows 10 could download updates. These updates could also provide software tweaks that make it difficult to run a pirated program. Now, will Windows 10 also do that for other games and other programs? That remains to be seen, and possibly not likely, because again, in a weird sort of way, Microsoft kind of benefits from you pirating other companies' games, just not their own games. So if they were to, you know, stop you from doing that, they could potentially hurt their own base of customers, because people might say, well, Windows 10 isn't for me. I'm going to go to, Apple, or I'm going to go to, Linux or whatever. So there's certainly a big debate on that particular notion. That being said, it's not like Windows 10 is the first to do this. In fact, it's already been done for quite a while by both Mac computers. And in fact, I mean, it is standard practice that when new software updates come out, they do try to close windows for hackers to, you know, get in and break license agreements. So it's not exactly that new. What's potentially creepy about it is that Windows is sort of deciding for you, no, you didn't pay for this. I'm taking it away from you. That's where it gets a bit creepy. So we'll have to see how that develops, and if there's actually any real evidence or if there's any cases of this actually happening, it'd be very interesting to look at that, and then to see where this conversation goes about the whole notion of privacy, copyright, and, you know, personal property. We'll see where that develops. Anyway, that was our Windows 10 update here on The Sector. Let's move on to our next topic. Prior to the break, I mentioned how we would look at police shootings in Canada and some of the difficulties that civil rights watchdog groups have in determining how fatal police encounters are in Canada and ultimately what can be done about it. I was looking at an article on Vice News discussing how easy or difficult it is for Canadian groups to get an assertion of how many times a civilian was shot and killed by Canadian police officers. The results were, to say the least, a little bit disturbing. According to data provided by the RCMP, 28 people died after being shot by federal police officers between 2010 and 2014, with dozens more suffering injuries. However, this is likely not the full story. What they uncovered was that the RCMP and police forces across Canada were very, very reluctant to share this information. Even through Freedom of Information Acts, it was incredibly difficult to get accurate numbers, and the numbers that they got often came without context. So even from the point of view of establishing a baseline or establishing some hard facts on the number of people shot by police officers, number of people who have been injured by police officers, and the cases around those injuries, most of that information is very difficult to piece together simply because of the lack of transparency amongst the police forces. And this, of course, obviously, I think, is to the detriment of everybody, including the police forces. It's very likely that in many of these cases, the police force was in the right. But without the context, it's very difficult to ascertain that. It's difficult to understand the motivations behind the officers in the shootings. It's difficult to understand the circumstances around them. And when we consider the wider implications, obviously, for instance, looking at America, the whole movement around Black Lives Matter has been trying to draw attention to the fact that there are other factors that go into understanding police shootings aside from simply, you know, the person was armed. And that there are other contexts and subtleties that sometimes get ignored in mainstream media and also don't tend to get reported in the normal narrative of a police shooting. Again, returning to the numbers, over the same four-year period of 2010 to 2014, a civilian watchdog group in Ottawa reviewed a total of 84 cases of police shootings. Now, keep in mind that this is significantly higher than the 28 people that the RCMP reported. Data from 2015 shows that Ontario police shot and killed another 6 individuals in 2015. In BC, police shot and killed 10 people from mid-2012 to mid-2015, although some of those shootings may have been at the hands of the RCMP and not local police forces. And again, as I mentioned, trying to get that extra context, their age, their gender, their race, mental health status, whether they were armed or unarmed, all of that information has been blocked. The RCMP refused to share it. Ironically, one of the few bits of information that the RCMP made available through other information databases was the use of tasers. And you may remember that the high-profile death of Robert Dzanski at the Vancouver airport when he was repeatedly tased by the RCMP, you know, may have facilitated that level of openness. And yet, despite, you know, a generally fairly low fatality rate with the use of tasers, it doesn't seem to be the most pressing issue to get information on, especially considering the fact that, you know, there may be a range of police shootings in Canada, you know, people dying from police encounters, anywhere from the low 30s to the high 80s, maybe even more significant variation as well. Which I think ultimately comes back to the main issue at hand here, is that in order to get any kind of information or make any kind of meaningful statement or understandings related to police violence in Canada, we need to have a better understanding of context. To use some more examples here, the Edmonton Police Force publishes the use of force on in their annual reports on their website, but they offer no real detail. So, for instance, they pointed their weapons 119 times in 2013 and fired once. But the report doesn't mention whether the subject was injured or killed. It doesn't mention the circumstances around that incident. So we don't know if that person was high on drugs or dealing with mental illness, or whether it was an armed robbery. We don't know. It's impossible to get any kind of real context, and without context, we can't understand how best to improve the situation. If we want to make sure that Canadian police officers are killing less people, which I think we can all agree is probably a good thing, then we need to understand what's happening and where things are going wrong. And if there's no transparency of information, how can we make that understanding happen? Again, consider the situation in Winnipeg, where the stats for the city are considerably vague. In 2014, there are reports tabulate 546, quote, firearm incidents over a three-year period. But there's no details on what those instances actually are. Were they weapon drawn, pointed, fired? Were people killed? What was the context? What were the circumstances? We don't know. And this doesn't really help anyone, including the police forces, I firmly believe, in making anything better. Because without any kind of open context, without the investigation aspect of this and transparency to the public to understand what's happening out there, we simply don't know. And we don't know if perhaps half of these instances were, say, race-motivated. I mean, that's probably a large percentage to guess, But again, looking at America, where we see some pretty significant details, very disturbing details regarding, you know, race-based police violence, one has to ask, what is the situation going on in Canada? And if we can't get any kind of clarity from the police forces, it does raise a lot of very disturbing questions about whether or not there is something that they're not telling us, or if we're simply not grasping something that's happening here in, you know, Canadian cities and provinces. When looking at the various reports and data that is available through the public and through research bodies and advocacy organizations and publicly held records, there does seem to be some evidence that there is a racial bias in police violence, at least a little bit. But again, we don't know for sure because we don't have enough of the information. BC, for instance, reported that about 20% of violent police interactions happen with Aboriginal peoples. A report by the SIU, which is the Special Investigations Unit, which is an independent civilian agency with the power to both investigate and charge police officers with criminal offenses. Anyway, the SIU found that they had a disproportionately high amount of use of force cases that involved Black or Aboriginal Ontarians. So again, there is some evidence here that, again, police force is being used disproportionately on minorities here in Canada. But without the proper context, we don't really know the extent or to even really any degree what exactly is happening. The SIU found that in Toronto, Black residents were nearly 10 times more likely to be shot and killed by police officers than city average. That's despite comprising less than 7% of the city's population. Additionally, they accounted for more than two-thirds of police shooting victims in 2000 to 2006. So ultimately, what are we to make of these findings? Well, at the very least, I think there is some cause for concern. We obviously don't have the full picture. We obviously don't understand exactly what is the mentality amongst law enforcement in Canada regarding these sorts of things. We know that in some cases, police officers have been charged with criminal offenses for shooting someone, a suspect, whether they were fleeing or resisting arrest. There have been cases of police brutality in Canadian history, recent history, of course. We also know that there are some pretty significant racial divides here in Canada. And although people like to think that there isn't, we know for a fact that there are, especially amongst Aboriginal peoples. We also know that there are huge gaps in law enforcement when it comes to providing service and protection to Aboriginal peoples. All of this, I think, points to a big issue here in the country that we're not really willing to investigate this issue with any kind of serious effort. We really need to be, I think, a bit more skeptical and a bit more critical of our own police force. And not so much in a way that we're belittling their effort. I mean, obviously, a lot of police officers have died in the line of duty. The 2014 Moncton shooting is a huge example of this. And we need to make sure that both police officers and the civilians that they're protecting are both empowered to, you know, feel safe and secure in their interactions with each other. We don't want a situation where eventually law enforcement and the public become so estranged and so against each other that every situation becomes a powder keg ready to erupt into violence. Ultimately, you know, this is going to depend, I think, a lot on transparency and a lot on civilian involvement in this process of understanding. Hopefully that will actually lead to some results. Anyway, let's take a quick break here on The Sector. We will return after this with more.
We all know that the word jazz means many different things to many different people. So check out The Real Deal on The Jazz Show at CITR 101.9 FM or CITR.ca for live streaming. Yours truly, Gavin Walker, is your host, and I guarantee the straight goods of 3 hours of jazz at its finest. So come on by and give your ears a musical workout, 9 p.m. Mondays. Don't miss it.
We just played Velvet Dinosaurs and their latest hit, Eating the Plate. Now, let's go to the phones and hear what you have to say. Go ahead, caller, you're on the line.
Master Dirty Red Scum!
Really?
Kill!
That's really
kill! Bad. Kill! Filthy bastard commies! I hate him! I hate him!
Okay, well, You know, maybe you should relax a little bit. You're listening to CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. And we are back here on The Sector on CITR with me, Ethan Clow. Just a reminder, if you want to participate in the show, send us your comments or give us any suggestions on topics, you can do so at sectorpodcast@gmail.com. That's our email address. You can also find us on Twitter at Ethan Clow, that's me, and at Sector Podcast, as well as on Facebook, facebook.com/sectorpodcast. And of course, you can find our podcast, our show notes, and all the other information you want about our show at sectorpodcast.wordpress.com. Of course, if you're listening via CITR, be sure to swing by our show and podcast section, subscribe to the podcast, and take a listen to some of the other great stuff on CITR. With the election coming up, getting very, very close, actually, we've been really harboring no secrets about our thoughts on the current political government here in Canada, Harper and the Conservatives. You know, it's not without reason. It's not simply just normal political bias. There is a shocking amount of information out there on Stephen Harper and his government's abuse of power in the Canadian government. Now, you might think that sort of compiling all this would be way too much work, but it turns out that the TIE has managed to do so. I was browsing their website and I come across an opinion piece where the author David Beers, along with, I think, other staff members, have actually compiled 70 abuses of power by the Harper government, as they quote it, assault on democracy. And, I mean, it's long. It's actually pretty detailed. Now, I'm not going to obviously go through every single one of them, but there are a few here that I thought would be kind of interesting just to kind of talk about here on the show and sort of share our own thoughts on. And, again, as the election is coming up and as important an election as this is going to be, not just from the point of view of social justice, but as I mentioned before, this is a show about nonprofits and charities and fundraising and, you know, philanthropy, making the world a better place. And this government has shown itself to be incredibly hostile to those philosophies. And as many, as I know, many, many colleagues who work in the industry have made sensible decisions to keep their opinions to themselves on this issue. I think, though, that as perhaps safeguarding that may seem, it's to their own potential detriment. Because if we don't speak out, if we don't make it clear that this government is not helping the charity sector, then we run the risk of people not realizing just how bad this government has been for the realm of social justice, but also the realm of just helping others. Let's look at a few examples from the first section of the article, abusing parliament, sabotage, scandals, corruption, and contempt. You know, normal categories when you talk about government. The Prime Minister's office was tied to the Senate hush money scandal. Now, this, of course, is decently in the news. Lots of issues around the Senate and corruption in the Senate. It's important to keep in mind that this all came from the Prime Minister's office. It's not like Stephen Harper was blindly innocent about these circumstances that were happening. He was part of the problem. Additionally, Harper was found in contempt of Parliament. He refused to disclose information on the costing of programs to Parliament, which Parliament, of course, is entitled to receive. The Harper government became the first in Canadian history to be found in contempt of Parliament. Again, the first in Canadian history. We've had some pretty bad politicians. That's saying something. Additionally, there were issues such as the clampdown on freedom of speech of diplomatic corps. Ottawa's diplomats must get all communications approved from conservative political operatives. Under Harper, the country's ambassadors are hardly heard from anymore. In a recent speech, former United Nations Ambassador Stephen Lewis said our political culture under the conservatives has descended into a, quote, nadir of indignity. Additionally, Harper has been no friend to science. The Harper government's downsizing of federal libraries includes sudden closing of 7 world-famous Departments of Fisheries and Oceans archives. A leaked memo revealed the destruction and consolidation would save less than $1 million. A rather unsatisfying result for the scientists whose work was being blocked and destroyed. The Harper government claimed that vital works would be digitally preserved, but never provided a plan or cost for doing so, nor any proof that it ever happened. No scientist interviewed by the TAI believed digitizing would or could replace what was lost. Again, related to the Harper government's environmental record, this was certainly no surprise, and again, underreported in today's media. Then, of course, was the situation with the UN when they blasted Canada's treatment of immigrants. Changes made to the immigration policy and refugee system under Harper were investigated by the United Nations Human Rights Committee. They issued a report in which they said that thousands of migrants were detained indefinitely without due process, many for over a year, and that many of them suffered from poor mental health support while being incarcerated. Along the same lines, the Harper government denied Qatar basic rights. Defying court rulings, the Conservative government refused to accord Omar Qatar's basic rights such as access to media. Editorialists of the right and left persuasion described the move as unbefitting a democratic government. Additionally, the Harper government undermined Stats Canada, killing data. Against pleas from practically everybody who needs and uses data from the long-form census, the Harper government scrapped it, prompting the Stats Canada chief to resign in protest. They muzzled the scientific community. Top scientists came under such heavy monitoring by the Conservatives that they staged death of evidence protests for being denied freedom of speech. The Conservatives sent out chaperones, or, quote, media minders, to track Environmental Canada scientists and report on them. Scientists weren't the only people to be muzzled. Like never before, limits were placed on media access. Journalists have been hard-pressed to recall another time when controls were put on them were so tight. At the Conservatives' 2013 Calgary Convention, reporters wrote of being harassed and penned in at every turn by the PMO's command and control system. In his book, Killing the Messenger, journalist Mark Bury charts the many examples of new limits of freedom of speech introduced in the Harper area. The Harper team additionally tried to ban journalists from asking questions. Veteran TV cameraman Dave Ellis covered a Harper speech about oil to a business audience. And though media had been instructed no questions were allowed, Ellis posed one about charges laid against a Conservative MP. The PMO tried to punish Ellis and his network by kicking him off Harper's trip to Malaysia. After the media hubbub, Harper backed down and Ellis went. And of course, we all know about the budget cuts to the CBC. After the 2011 federal election, Heritage Minister James Moore assured Conservatives would maintain or increase support for the CBC. Yet, the next year, the HarperCons delivered the biggest government cut to the CBC since the mid-1990s. And of course, I need not remind anyone listening about the Conservatives' use of the CRA to attack charities. But not all charities, of course. Just the ones that don't seem adequately aligned with the Harper brand. Environmental aid, human rights, and free speech charities have banded together to push back against what looks like politically motivated witch hunt. Now, again, as we've covered this a lot, I'm not going to go too much into this, but again, it's not the only time that the Conservatives have targeted groups through really strong-arm tactics. The Conservatives in the Senate actually broke Senate rules in an effort to get across Harper's anti-union bill, which I think we've covered before in the past and some of its obscene abuses of power. But the fact that they were willing to break Senate law, overrule their own Senate speaker, and overrule them when he actually called them on the fact that they were breaking Senate law in order to pass this bill, which is almost certainly unconstitutional, is just a remarkable disregard for democracy and the rule of law in the own Senate. It's just shocking. Now, of course, that's not all. There's a whole bunch of other abuses that have been documented in this article, and again, we'll post it to our show notes on our website, centerpodcast.wordpress.com. I encourage you to go take a look at them. I mean, it is quite amazing just how many of these abuses of power have been cataloged, clearly reported on, and yet ultimately there's very little conversation of this happening in mainstream media. And in an election year, you think this would be a bit more front and center, and yet arguably it's not. Which I guess kind of leads into the next big question here on the show, is that what is being talked about in this political coverage? You know, ultimately, what do Canadians think are the big issues going on for the next couple of years? What are we voting about here in Canada? Clearly, it's not these issues. Clearly, that we're not talking about abuses of power and circumventing democracy and changing traditions that were put in place for very good reasons to ensure openness and transparency in government. You know, these are not becoming primary issues. Ultimately, it's a bit disturbing that despite the fact that scientists have been muzzled and the environment has been, you know, decimated, the fact that charities have been muzzled, media has been pushed as far away from government as it's ever been in Canadian history, the fact that we are seeing blatant disregard for our own rule of law in terms of what government can and cannot do, what political parties are allowed to do in terms of fundraising, in terms of attack ads, in terms of elections and protocol, none of that is really being made clear, I think, to the voter. So unfortunately, ultimately, a lot of this stuff tends just to get, viewed as political bias, when in fact, it's documented fact, and why is it not getting reported on more? So that's a big question. Anyway, we're going to take a quick break here on the show. When we come back, I want to talk a bit about, you know, some of the issues that are on display in the election and why we're talking about those above, you know, things like this. So let's stay tuned. Hopefully, we'll find it very fascinating and interesting. We'll be right back after this.
Let's listen in as one poor soul tries to find something good to enjoy on the radio. Let's see here.
God. Oh.
Everybody dance, dance. What, you don't like to dance? Everybody dance.
Oh. Everybody. God, this is awful.
Well, I climbed up the mountain, climbed back down again for you. I climbed up the mountain again for you, and then I climbed back down, climbed up.
Isn't there anything?
Listening to the radio these days can be distressing. Fortunately, here at CITR, our programmers choose the music that they play, so our charts reflect what people actually listen to. To find out what's really topping the charts, pick up a copy of Beatroot or Discorder magazine, or check us out online at citr.ca. Unless, of course, you'd rather keep listening to the chart-topping single, Everybody Dance.
What, you don't like to dance? Everybody dance. Everybody dance. Everybody dance, dance. What, you don't like to dance? Everybody.
I got a stack of records here, a stack of records there. I got records scattered all over everywhere, but I'm looking.
Discorder magazine has been supporting independent music for over 30 years, and it keeps on living by joining efforts with local music supporters such as Vinyl Records. You can find a selection of Vinyl Records' featured albums on the back cover of Discorder and can support your favorite local bands and artists by purchasing their records. For more information on their vast selection of new, used, and rare music, go to vinylrecords.ca.
Days have found us. Strange days have tracked us down. They're going to destroy our pride.
And we are back here on The Sector with me, Ethan Clow, talking about social justice, nonprofits, and charities. Well, right now we're actually talking about politics in the upcoming Canadian election, which is only literally a month or so away. Now, prior to that, we were just talking about the sort of abuses of power by the Harper government. And again, some of the really unprecedented things that have happened under his watch. And trying to make it clear that this is not something about political bias. This is not something about politicking on behalf of the NDP or the Liberals or the Greens, but simply just pointing out the fact that this has been a very different government than anything that we've had in Canadian history. And people need to be a bit more aware of that, especially now with the election coming up. And given the fact that there's been some very strange political topics that have come up in the last little while. You know, the Conservative government has made a lot about Trudeau's hair. I get so much so that one has to wonder if, I don't know, does Stephen Harper have a bit of a hair issue? Maybe, who knows? The point being, of course, is that what we're talking about in this political cycle seems to be not terribly relevant to the actual issues at hand. Ironically enough, the economy, and usually the economy becomes the main issue for political matters like this. But what does the economy have to say to us in terms of the direction our country is going? Why is the economy so heavily focused this year? I wanted to kind of maybe discuss that a little bit. Hopefully get a bit of feedback from you as well, the listener. You know, if you've been watching the debates, if you've been following the news, what are your thoughts on that? You know, how do you view the economy as a political issue? But let's back up a little bit. Let's kind of put this in perspective a little here. To look back a little bit on the political system, in previous elections, Harper often campaigned himself as a stabilizing force. If you look back at his old campaign ads, a lot of it focused on, you know, getting work done, working late, taking care of the economy, strengthening the Canadian system, making sure that there are jobs and that people are paying lower taxes and whatnot. Very kind of like a very hardworking, diligent person. And yet, looking at the economy today and in this political cycle, we can really see that this is not the case. The economy is not doing well. While other countries have managed to pull out of the recession and start to get things back on course, Canada hasn't. Our economy still struggles to produce new jobs. Lower taxes hasn't really helped us in terms of making sure that we have a budget for taking care of social services. Additionally, we're actually going backwards a lot in how we structure our economy. We're relying more on fossil fuels. We're relying more on things like the oil sands. We're becoming more dependent on foreign oil as well. Instead of developing greener technologies and ultimately investing in things like solar and other forms of green technology that we have available at our disposal, we've been largely ignoring those issues. We've made the oil sands such a prominent discussion point, and that the point has become you're either for jobs and the economy or you're not. And we've allowed that conversation to go on for so long that nobody really questions it anymore. And again, if you look at the facts, if you look at where we are as a nation and where our economy is, it's clearly not good. And yet, why are we allowing this to be used as some kind of trump card in the political debates? Why are we even focusing so much on the economy that we're not discussing social issues? We're not discussing spying. We're not discussing abuses of power. We're not discussing the environment or science or any of the things that have happened that have ultimately changed the way this country functions. A lot of this, I think, comes down to the notion that for many people, the economy is the only real voting issue. It's the only concern that they have front and center. I mean, having a job and getting paid and ultimately, you know, being able to look after yourself, that's pretty important. And I'm not going to deny that at all. But the problem is that we focus on it so much that we don't really pay attention to the other very serious issues that these political parties are advocating.
I think it would be a very big mistake to, for instance, lump the Liberals and the NDP together in the same boat if they happen to just sort of say the same things about the economy. An NDP government would be very different than a Liberal government. We can, you know, obviously see that provincially, you know, just across the country. Of course, nationally, we just kind of assume that each party is going to say, we can strengthen the economy, we can generate more jobs, we can do this, we can do that. Which is all fine and good, but it tends to make them all sort of sound the same. And when they sound the same, people just get disillusioned. They don't feel inclination to vote. They don't feel inclination to get involved. And it creates that viewpoint that, you know, all of politics is essentially the same. Whereas if they talked more a bit about policy and advocacy, if they talked more about what they actually stand for, and if they could tie their political ideas and their economic ideas into a clearly discernible viewpoint, that would be something else. That'd be a bit different, right? Because then we could understand, you know, why would the NDP be different than the Liberals in terms of building the economy up? Instead, if we keep the conversation so focused on job creation and these terms that don't necessarily mean a whole lot, and even if they do, they're very obtuse, they're not very clear to the average person, it makes the whole conversation seem just kind of plainly boring. And ultimately, it plays to the services of, say, Stephen Harper, who can just kind of tote the old, you know, we're going to continue with the path that we set down, we're going to keep focusing on our hard work, et cetera, et cetera. They're not being challenged. No one's coming forward and saying, hey, look, you know, you're advocating for a policy that is demonstrably unjust. Instead, the conversation stays rooted to this notion of stability as opposed to the notion of progress. And I think that's a very important factor here in our political system, and that we need to ultimately encourage that conversation. It's actually interesting to compare this to what's going on in America right now. You know, the whole like Donald Trump phenomenon, as obnoxious as he is, there are people out there, I mean, like serious political commentators, who are actually starting to say, you know, he could legitimately make a run for the White House. But you get to, like, you really have to wonder, you know, would Americans tolerate such a obviously racist and offensive person? And they clearly would. So you really have to wonder, like, what is going on? And when you hear the political commentators and the, you know, the Rachel Meadows and the et ceteras of the world, they're almost excited by the notion because Trump is interesting to cover because he doesn't use the same sort of political speech that everyone else does. And again, if a politician can stand out in that way, it's good for them. I mean, ultimately, Trump is a horrible, horrible thing to happen for American politics because he is, you know, giving voice to a lot of really, you know, awful ideologies and very awful opinions. But what's interesting is if you compare it to Canada, we have a lot of things to get worked up about here in this country. I mean, I just read a whole bunch of abuses of power by the Harper government. And yet, we're so comfortable to keep this conversation focused on the economy and stability and blah, blah, blah. We're not really making any kind of headway. We're not differentiating our political system in any way or meaningful sense. People can honestly say they don't understand the difference between the Liberals and the Conservatives. That may be totally true, because if you look at what they're saying, it's not all that distinguishable. What we need is for the political parties to start branching out and making some really clear, discernible statements on why they are different from each other. Ultimately, that would hopefully generate a bit more political involvement and a bit less apathy. And again, it's really interesting to look at the way that people are talking about Trump. Many people are saying, you know, yeah, I don't like him and I don't like what he says, but at least he's saying it. And they appreciate the fact that he's just willing to say anything that comes into his head. And, you know, let's face it, there's not much in there in the first place. But the fact that he's willing to just sort of stand up and say, yeah, I say things that are like totally sexist, I guess, whatever. It's oddly refreshing. And I mean, again, like I think, again, to be very clear, he is a disaster of a human being. And the fact that he's even gotten this far, I think, shows a lot of really disturbing facts about the American system. But again, it wouldn't be that hard to believe that someone could come along in the Canadian system and do the exact same thing. And we've allowed that to happen. We've created this framework of conversation around the election that is both ludicrous and boring at the same time. And, you know, you look at what Pierre Trudeau did, Justin Trudeau's father. In many ways, he was that kind of guy. He spoke what he wanted to say. He didn't seem to be very much limited or controlled by conventions at the time. And amazingly, people responded to that. You know, it's really kind of funny to watch how Justin Trudeau is sort of not like that at all. He really hasn't made any kind of effort, or I guess hasn't had any success in really differentiating his party from the Conservatives. You know, the fact that the Liberals supported the Bill 51, the spying bill, is one of those reasons that, well, I guess it's an instant where instead of standing out from the crowd and making a firm stand that people remember the way the NDP did, they just get kind of lumped in with the same old, same old. And I think that we're actually seeing the result of that. The fact that the NDP are kind of surging in the polls probably, I think, points to the fact that prior to the most recent elections coverage, the NDP were venturing beyond, you know, the same old a little bit. Well, Clare has kind of dialed it back a little bit, and you kind of get that process where they start to homogenize a little bit towards the end. But again, it's too bad, because I think when they drive apart like that, that's when ultimately people get engaged. So I don't know how to conclude this whole thought experiment, but again, I think that we need to encourage less conversation on like the economy, at least in the sense of the way it's usually talked about. I think we need to force more conversation on these key issues. The facts that make Harper different from Trudeau and Mulcair and the Green Party, these need to be front and center. And if we just talk about things like the economy and job creation and lower taxes, they're all going to sound the same. But if we start saying and start making this conversation about the fact that there have been radical changes to Canadian political understanding, political history, political tradition, that is where we can start to see some more engagement and a bit more differentiation amongst the political parties. So I encourage you to do that. Write to your MP and write to the CBC and you know, make this conversation more front and center. Anyway, we are actually running out of time here on The Sector. This has been episode 52, and we'll be back for us next week, so we'll have more coming up. Don't worry, there'll be more. But I wanted to say thank you for tuning in. Thank you for listening. We will wrap things up, and stay tuned on CITR. We have more great content coming up. Up on the Roof is following our show. We will see you all next week here on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. Same time, same channel. This is Ethan Clough signing off for The Sector. We'll see you all next week.